This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast, in partnership with News Radio 600 COGO. I'm Andrea Lopez Villafana, Managing Editor at Voice of San Diego. And I'm joined, as always, by Andrew Keats, fellow Managing Editor. What's up, Andy?
Not a lot. How are you?
Why do we still call you Andrew Keats?
It's my byline.
Yeah, but no one calls you Andrew.
No, I mean, it is my byline. You could.
It's too weird. It's too formal. Coming up on the show this week, the 2023 Parents Guide to San Diego Schools is out. Our big annual education project aims to capture data for more than 700 schools and deliver the most useful insights and stories about local education. It's out now. We'll explain the highlights, how to use it, and share our favorite stories. And on the second half of the show, we have senior investigative reporter Lisa Halverstadt. She's going to break down her new investigation into San Diego detox facilities. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Andy, you and I were gone. Our fans noticed, probably. They missed us.
They were, but we were back last week.
Yeah.
But we were gone before that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we came out strong.
We just walked right back in.
Yeah.
You don't forget to do it. You know?
It's like riding a bike, which I don't know how to do.
It's like what riding a bike would be like if you knew. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to learn how to ride a bike?
No.
You have no interest in that?
No interest.
Have people annoyed you by asking you this in the past, I imagine?
I don't think I've told anybody, really.
Wow. Well, you're saying it into a so microphone now, right now. It's telling a lot of people.
Maybe people will tweet at me.
Okay.
They'll teach me how to ride a bike.
Well, if you want to learn, we could handle that, I'm sure. But if you don't want to learn, that's fine, too. You've made it this far. Who cares?
I'm a professional pedestrian.
You know what I would say?
Uh-huh.
Riding a bike is exhilarating.
Oh.
It is an exhilarating feeling.
Okay.
I love it. There are times where I think, like, I'm sure flying would be better, but I don't think it would be that much better.
Hmm.
That's how exhilarating I think riding a bike is sometimes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I see. So talking about non-car riding modes of transportation, you were in Japan.
Uh-huh. Yes.
While we were gone, and you witnessed something very cool. Lots of cool things, I'm sure.
Yeah, sure. I had a great time.
Mm-hmm.
Saw some cool things. Yeah, I'm a little sheepish about talking about trips because.
Why?
Because I always feel like people, when they come back from a place, sound like they're the first person in the world to ever go there. You know? Like they're carrying secrets when actually, like, millions of people go.
Yeah.
So, but I did have an observation.
Mm-hmm.
Cycling in Tokyo is ubiquitous.
Okay.
Everywhere. Go to a transit station, there's hundreds and hundreds of bikes parked there. Mm-hmm. You see people on the roads all the time. You know what you do not see? Is any protected bike lanes.
What?
They don't have protected bike lanes.
People just...
People just ride. They mostly take side streets, I think, to get away from busy roads, you know, mm-hmm. and where they, you know, sort of stay to the side. There's mm-hmm. Just a thriving bike culture, and it just is expected to coexist with cars.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, which is different than when you go to Amsterdam. There's everyone rides a bike in Amsterdam, but it's all on protected, separated right away.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I accidentally made a wrong turn and got into a car lane in Amsterdam one time. And like, it's like the entire city stopped to like wag their finger at me. It was like I had committed a significant faux pas.
Uh-huh.
But I'm just, I was just amused in general by the prevalence of cycling without any protected infrastructure mm-hmm. based on the way we talk about the necessity of public infrastructure if we're going to increase cycling usage. Yeah.
So they just share the road.
They no problems. The road, no problems. Hiccups. People, you know, people drive a little bit slower. I think mm-hmm. that's a big part of it. The roads are not as dangerous. Also, the cars are smaller significantly. So, you know, I think both of those are parts of it. But the thing that they do have is like unparalleled density.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a lot of people. And so I think it creates necessary circumstances to ride a bike.
Yeah.
That maybe we're trying to shortcut with the physical infrastructure, with protected bike lanes.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, I just thought it was noteworthy. A lot of people riding bikes, not a lot of protected bike lanes. Not any, as far as I can tell.
Fascinating. Yeah. I'd love to see that. I'm one of those drivers who never knows what to do when there's a bike around me. I'm just afraid of bikes. Yeah, well, in general.
This is just one of the many road. Things you've mentioned that you don't quite
road
know
anxieties.
How to, not quite. You don't quite know how to handle.
I'm like, do I go around and I got cars behind me? Yeah. Now they're gonna think like, I'm dumb. And
on ramps,
do?
Off ramps,
freeway on ramps,
turn lanes.
Whoever designed our freeways, let's talk.
Yeah, I don't. Some of this stuff might be a you problem. I don't know. At least some of it.
As we sit in this podcast studio, that smells like a Chipotle burrito.
Does it?
Doesn't smell like a Chipotle burrito to you?
I don't know, man.
Well, you just had Chipotle, but you gave your leftover to our producer.
Yeah.
Who ate it in the podcast room.
Uh-huh.
And it smells like Chipotle.
Okay.
Okay. As we sit in this podcast room. I'm hungry. As we sit in this podcast room, you have this beautiful, beautiful magazine uh-huh. before you.
I do.
The 2023 Parents Guide to San Diego Schools. We released it this week. How long have we been doing this? It's our fifth annual.
Yeah. You spent a lot of time on this bad boy.
A lot of time.
How do you feel being done?
I am relieved.
Mm-hmm.
Really
but,
proud.
But unsatisfied.
Yeah. Well, I'm proud of the work that mm-hmm. we accomplished, but I think I've mostly been focused on pulling together feedback. Just I'm that type of person. I like to...
You got that growth mindset.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, okay, what did we do? How can we do it better?
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of makes it hard to enjoy, but...
Rise and grind culture coming from you.
Girl boss.
Okay.
I girl boss too hard, yeah. as the kids say.
Right.
And now I'm wondering how to make it better. No, but it's a product that we've put out for a couple years now, and it basically it's a database of 700 plus schools in the entire county. We've got different schools and from districts all over the county, data on performance, teacher experience,
chronic absenteeism, percentage of English learners, mm-hmm. special programs that all these schools have. There's
dual language.
I mean, genuinely like a wealth of information.
Yeah, it's so much.
In fact, the primary task that we have
mm-hmm.
is with handling this much information is just displaying it in a way that you can actually use it.
Yeah.
It makes it actually useful because otherwise you can have all the information in the world, but if it's incomprehensible, it does you no good.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really in the like information architecture space here.
Everything you need to know mm-hmm. about schools in San Diego here. One nice place and charter schools goes everything from elementary to high schools.
Yeah. So, I don't. I mean, what leaps out to you about this resource, which is really what it is? I mean, we have very good journalism here. There's multiple stories mm-hmm. that people should read if they're interested in education. that, you know, are a dose of reality mm-hmm. into the sorts of things that are going on in San Diego County schools. But then there's also the guide itself. Yeah. And the guide itself is just a massive resource. What about that resource stands out to you?
So I'm not a parent, mm-hmm. but I, well, dog mom. But but I remember when...
Don't do that.
but I remember when I was younger and my parents are both undocumented, didn't really speak English. And I remember we lived in Long Beach and it was not a nice area of Long Beach in the school that I was supposed to go to. You know, neighbors would talk about it and my mom had heard a couple of things about it and she decided that she didn't want me to go to that school. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was quite a journey for her as an undocumented, Spanish speaking immigrant to try to understand how and if she could move me to a different school. And she figured out that process and I got into a different school from the one that was my neighborhood school. But I just think back at that time, I remember she was so stressed trying to navigate this process.
Yeah, it's amazing.
With zero information.
Yeah, to think about like the procedural requirements of actually doing it and interacting with the school district. And then the decision-making that you'd have to rely on about, okay, if not, how do I know that this school's not good? Mm-hmm. How do I figure that out? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, is ripe for bad decision making mm-hmm. potentially. And then where do I want you to go?
Yeah.
How do I make that decision? It's a huge task for anyone. Throwing being like, you know, a marginalized member of the community. It's just so hard.
And I just think about like how cool would it have been if mm-hmm. I could have given, you know, someone could have given her a parent's guide mm-hmm. that explains what school choice is, what windows you have for which school districts, and what that process can look like, right? That you can look at your neighborhood school. How does your neighborhood school compare to other schools? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how you go about that process. Just something like that would have been so useful for her. So I think the ability to have that key information that you need to have as a parent to make those decisions and even just understand how the system works and what options you have is just... incredible.
Yeah. The idea of ranking schools, which we don't do, to be clear, mm-hmm. at all. But, you know, there's a look and feel that is like ranking schools here, mm-hmm. I guess, is a fraught path. Mm-hmm. It is a controversial topic area and partially because it's very difficult.
Yeah.
But we have, I think, taken a really thoughtful approach here, which is we have numbers that recognize that there are all kinds of different ways for schools to be good or bad, mm-hmm. or for schools to be underperforming and overperforming. You can benchmark them to other schools like them and compare them to one another while considering the socioeconomic realities of that school. Mm-hmm. You know, which schools are doing better than you would otherwise expect? Which mm-hmm. schools are doing worse? Or is a school, by its own standards, improving or getting worse? What's the trend line on that school? All that information is in here. Which is all stuff we go about with the idea of being thoughtful and serious and recognizing that the idea of a bad school or a mm-hmm. good school is fundamentally going to be a misnomer. There's mm-hmm. right schools for you and
schools for other people.
And schools for other people, and you need sort of robust information to even come close to making that decision. Mm-hmm. I, as a parent, find that people are just immensely thankful to have this. There's like nothing we do where people are more just like on a personal level, just mm-hmm. appreciative. Like people don't act like that way about stories for the most part. They say, oh, it's a really good story, or mm-hmm. you know, I really value journalism or something like that. But it's not like you did them a personal favor. This guide, people receive it and it's like we did a personal favor for them.
Was it you who said people didn't believe you had a real job until they saw the parents' guide and they're like, Oh,
that goofy nonprofit he claimed to work for, I guess, actually pays him a salary or something.
I love that. Well, we have a lot of stories Of course, the data and how-to guides on how to navigate this very complex system. We are also going to have in-person information sessions rolling out. The first one is Monday, March 6th. Register at vosd.org/schools.
We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover Seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com.
There's a common misconception about substance abuse treatment in San Diego, that people don't want help, and that it's easy to get clean. But senior investigative reporter Lisa Halverstadt dug in and found something troubling. At a time when drug overdoses are surging, vulnerable people seeking a safe place to stop using are usually forced to wait for a bed or never able to access one. Hey, Lisa. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Andrea. Hey, Andy.
All right. So, Lisa, why don't we start with big picture availability? So, the purposes of your story that we published yesterday were focused on services available, detox services that were available for people who are on Medi-Cal. So that's not people who have private insurance that they pay for. These are low-income people many of whom are homeless, but certainly not all everyone, people who are on Medi-Cal. How much availability is there for detox beds for people who are on Medi-Cal across San Diego County?
So there are about 70 detox beds.
70
for a county of more than 3 million people.
Yeah. 70 beds. So before we even, I mean, it's such a low number.
And none in the city of San Diego.
None in the city of San Diego. Yeah. So where are they? Tell us, lay the groundwork a little bit for how these, the capacity and the services are available.
So there are some beds in North County. Mm-hmm. There are some beds out in Campo, pretty far out. There are some beds in Lemon Grove. There are no beds in the city of San Diego, which is the place where about half of the fentanyl overdose deaths have occurred the last few years.
Okay. So before we even get into however many people on the street are dealing with substance abuse problems, how many other people who are not homeless at all who are dealing with substance abuse problems, and whatever percentage of all of those people who want to get clean, we are talking about such a small number. I mean, a fraction of a fraction of what we are capable of offering to a person who says, I'm ready to get clean right now. And the sorts of services that are the first step. You go, you get clean at these sorts of programs, and then you can start, you know, a real rehab program. But first, you go to these detox facilities. We have overall, for all of the people who fall in any of those categories I just talked about, 70.
70 beds. And I think it's important to note that there are access issues on top of that as well. So the detox programs that we currently have, although there's some effort to try to fix some of these things, there are intake processes that make it difficult for people to get into them efficiently. Mm-hmm. There are also limitations on the medical services that can be provided. So many people may have some sort of other medical issue, or there may be a medical issue that's coming up during their withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And these programs that we have currently are not able to serve people that have issues that, you know, rise to a certain level. And though
yeah, these aren't hospitals.
These are not hospitals.
Right.
And so those add additional limitations on access.
So, yeah, you get through the fact that there aren't that many beds. You get through the fact that it's difficult to maneuver the system, to go through the administration process to actually get into one. And then at the end of the line, it may be that the facility isn't even well suited for you because basically what they can offer is a bed to get clean in, not all of the other medical care that you may need.
Yes.
I mean, that seems pretty bad. This, like, in terms of identifying problems, this one seems like a pretty open and shut case that as long as this is the situation, as long as there are 70 total detox beds in San Diego County, that we've got a significant inhibitor on our ability to get some of the people who are in the worst shape on the streets, some of the people who are most likely to end up on the streets because of the condition that they're in right now and the addiction that they're dealing with, that the what we have to offer them is so insufficient to the problem. That seems just like as clear as a conclusion as one can draw in a world of uncertainties.
It's reporting this story, it was really hard on me. I'm going to be honest. Mm-hmm. It was really sad to see how the system is failing people consistently mm-hmm. who are being courageous mm-hmm. in saying that they're ready to change their lives. And then there's not a bed for them. And I think something that perfectly encapsulates that is a data point that I got from the McAllister Institute, which happens to be one of the biggest detox providers in town, but they also run a sobering center just outside downtown San Diego. Now, you can't just walk into the center. Most people are taken by law enforcement because mm-hmm. they're under the influence in public. And in the last 6 months of 2022, less than 8% of people who went into that facility and literally said, yes, I would like detox, got detox within the 23 hours or so that they're allowed to remain in that facility.
So somebody is actively intoxicated. They go to this facility, typically by a police officer because they're, you know, intoxicated in public. They're actively high or they're actively intoxicated. And the people running that sobering center say, would you like us to put you in a detox bed? And they say yes. And 92% of the time, there is no bed to give them.
Exactly. Now, I do think it's important to point out, not everybody going through addiction mm-hmm. needs detox.
Right.
You know, a lot of people do have that supportive family. Mm-hmm. You know, they have stable housing. They have good insurance. Or, you know, so that they're able to easily access different services. There's also, you know, increasingly connections to medication-assisted treatment, which mm-hmm. can be really helpful. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people do need it. Mm-hmm. And right now what's happening is, you know, McAllister and Interfaith Community Services, another provider, they're literally telling me they're getting dozens of calls, desperate calls for help every day.
You had an anecdote in your story that was amazing to me that one of the staffers who works at one of these clinics said when she parks her car while she's walking from her car to the facility in the morning, typically one or two people every day run to her and say, can you please take me in? Do you have a bed for me? People waiting outside the facility, essentially begging a person. They say, it looks like you work here. Can you please take me in?
Yes. It's, and I think
the moment of desperation, the moment they're looking for help in the most tangible way a human can ask another human for help. And she has to say no.
Mm-hmm. Yes, often. Although I will say, you know, McAllister told me they make every effort. And I'm sure of all the providers, if somebody presents themselves at the facility, they want to do everything they can to try mm-hmm. to get that person in. But how many people are just as desperate? Right. And just couldn't make it to the facility. So one thing that came up, you know, in my process of reporting, talking to somebody who's been really trying to get into detox. And thankfully, this past week, he did get in. But he was talking about how there was a facility when he lived in Nevada that you could just walk in. And, you know, sometimes you might wait several hours in the waiting room. But you would be seen that day mm-hmm. and you could be connected with something. And San Diego doesn't have a place like that. We don't have a place where people are in this desperate position, can just walk in. And so what's happening is they're calling a bunch of different places. You know, maybe somebody is trying to help them and is making those calls, or sometimes they're desperately showing up. I heard about one instance, a woman literally pushing her shopping cart to the McAllister facility in Lemon Grove. Can you imagine how much effort that took her to get there?
Yeah, it's crazy.
So what was the individual you just spoke about? You mentioned his story in your article. What was his journey like?
Oh, boy. So I've been talking to Ryan now for a few weeks throughout his journey with this. He had a tough situation come up. He'd previously, you know, struggled with addiction, but had been in recovery for a few years. And a tough situation came up and he relapsed, started using fentanyl. Mm-hmm. He'd been going for years to a methadone clinic successfully. And early last month, he decided, okay, I got to turn this around. This is not going well. And so with the help of a case manager at the methadone clinic that he goes to, you know, they started calling, trying to get him into a detox bed. He ended up waiting 21 days to get a bed. And during that time he was waiting, it was just excruciating for him. He made a tough decision at one point, maybe he should take some time off work because, gosh, if a detox bed's going to be open, you know, you want to be able to get in lickety-split, right? And then he's waiting, and finally he got so desperate, he actually checked himself into the hospital, if you can imagine. He said he was suicidal, and they kept him for 2.5 days. Well, when that time was up, they said, well, looks like your mental health condition is better.
Yeah, they're not a detox facility.
They're not a detox facility.
They checked him in because he said he was suicidal. When they got to the position that he had that moment of crisis had calmed down, they said, you know, we're not keeping you here until you're clean. We're, you know, and they put him back out.
And so he ends up going home and starting to use again because he's been using to try to function. Because I think what a lot of people don't understand is that it gets to a point when somebody's dealing with addiction where they're so reliant on this drug to just be normal. And normal might be a little different for them than it is for maybe some of us, but that's how they're just functioning. If they don't use, you know, they could be having cold sweats, they could be vomiting, just all sorts of horrible symptoms. And so, you know, at that point, he literally said to me, you know, he felt like he was failing and questioning is, am I going to make it through this? And he then waited another week to get into a detox bed. Another week after that.
Yeah. I mean, you also, you talk to a lot of experts in the story, and one of them said that the most important thing, all available research says, is that when somebody says they're ready to get clean, that you have an option for them right then. Not in an hour, not in a week, right then. And so this guy's, I mean, you know, he's waiting 21 days with all of these steps in between. It's, I mean, thank God he managed to get into a facility at the end of that, at that 21 day period. But there's a million different ways that could have gone in that time.
Yes. And there's so many people that can't hold on like Ryan did.
Yeah.
I think that's really important to mention. You know, I was talking to, you know, a lot of people in the process of the story who've tried to help people get detox beds or work with people who do. And it really struck me, you know, talking to the Rescue Mission, which has a recovery sort of model associated with its homeless serving programming, too. The vice president for the Rescue Mission told me that their outreach workers have literally stopped suggesting detox to people that they know would qualify and could benefit from that service because it's so likely that they are not going to be able to get a bed quickly and that there's going to be this whole rigmarole of, you know, barriers and, you know, other issues that that person's just going to drop off. And so let's try something else. And I talked to another homeless outreach worker, Michelle Lefevre with Father Joe's Villages, who is in recovery herself. And she just talked about how many people that she's lost along the journey and getting so excited that, oh, today's the day for this person because, wow, they took that first step. And then they didn't hold on. They couldn't hold on for the number of days or even hours sometimes.
I mean, what Ryan's story, what the that anecdote from the rescue mission, what this all paints a picture of, this is just whatever percent you believe detox facilities are as the whole of our services sector for solving this problem. Whatever share you think they are, we just don't have it. I mean, that's fundamentally what this is. We just don't have a genuine detox offering. It's just not part of what we can do in this county, apparently. I mean, if you were looking for something and 92% of the time you didn't find it in a certain place, you would just stop searching there. Mm-hmm. And that's what the rescue mission people are telling you, are saying. You get no 92% of the time, you stop asking that question.
And I think it's important, too, to just note that this does seem like a bigger problem in central San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, anybody who walks downtown these days can see that there are a lot of people in need. And maybe, you know, a fraction of those people need detox. But for extremely vulnerable people, if they raise their hand, you need to be able to help them right away. And we just do not have that capacity right now.
Yeah, I'm under no delusions that we, like, if we were to get to 1,500 detox beds, that suddenly every person on the streets in downtown San Diego would put their hands up and be willing to go, or that even all of those people need detox. But it is such a failure to not be able to offer it to the people who do want it. I mean, it's a simple goal that the number of people turned away when ready for and open to going into to detox, that should be zero. That's a simple goal that the region and the various players that work in this sector could and should set.
Well, and certainly the providers, I would say, they're feeling this so viscerally, mm-hmm. too. They know that they're not able to provide as much as needed. You know, they get the calls from people literally, you know, that same intake person you talked about who, you know, people will run to her car. She was saying people will literally say on the phone, if you don't get me in today, I'm going to die. Because a lot of times they literally just went through an overdose or something tough happened and they're at this moment of clarity that now they want to get help, please now.
Yeah. They're aware. They feel the monkey on their back that's calling them away from it. They know it's a fleeting moment that they have to go get into this facility. That is a sobering picture of desperation. I find it incredibly depressing just to think that we would be so ill-equipped to handle that piece of the problem, however big you think that piece is. It just seems like something we should be expected to do.
Well, and I will say that those same providers that I mentioned, they all want to expand as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some money that the city and county have doled out to McAllister, for example, to try to dramatically expand. But the issue is they're struggling to find places to put the beds.
Yeah. So is it's more opportunity than it is funds?
I believe
presumably it's both, but
a bit of both, but mostly I think it is, you know, finding locations. I think that there is a sense, wow, this obviously help is needed.
Mm-hmm.
There is an opportunity to potentially, could the city or county use some of their opioid settlement funds, mm-hmm. to try to put into addressing this problem? But you know, I have a lot of questions, and this is something I want to continue to dig into because I don't think, you know, that I can come away from a story like this and just walk away and move to the next one.
Yeah, no, there's more to be done here. But we should also say Ryan, not his name. We changed his name in our story for obvious reasons so we could discuss his private personal situation. But thanks for doing the story. It's very good. And as you said, more to be done.
More to be done.
Thanks, Lisa. You can read Lisa's latest investigation and all her stories at vosd.org/Lisa. That's vosd.org/Lisa.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast in San Diego. You can check out that 2023 Parents Guide to San Diego Schools now at vosd.org/schools. That's vosd.org/schools. Link is in the show notes. Andrea Lopez Villafana is managing editor at Voice of San Diego. Andrew Keats is also managing editor. I'm Nate John, producer for the show. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.